The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Harm Reduction International has released a new report entitled The Global State of Harm Reduction 2024. HRI announced the release of this report at a news conference on the morning of Tuesday, October 29th. With a summary of their findings, here's HRI's Acting Executive Director, Colleen Daniels.
So what did we do this year with our report? Well, we had a look at our previous reports, and we noticed that there were some areas that were being truly neglected when it comes to harm reduction. And we noticed that there are some populations who are even more neglected when it comes to access to harm reduction services. And so this year we decided to focus on some of those populations and those issue areas, simply because when we looked at the data, we have minimal incremental increases. So, you know, we have a few more countries who are actually providing opioid agonist therapy, for example. We have a few more providing drug consumption rooms, but we're not really seeing the actual key issues around implementation being addressed. So that's what we wanted to do today. And thanks to a coordinated effort of almost 300 harm reduction practitioners, academics, advocates, and activists from 101 countries, we were able to produce this report today. And of course, it covers a range of health and social services for people who use drugs, as well as some civil society and drug policy developments, along with the dire situation when it comes to funding, where we actually have a 94% funding gap in low and middle income countries for harm reduction. One of the areas that we decided to, when we looked at all our data and we looked at the trends across a few reports, we realized that we really couldn't find much about young people and harm reduction services. And what is their access? And what are the issues that need to be addressed in order for them to be able to access services, particularly since they are one of the largest numbers in terms of populations who use drugs around the world. We also looked at the data around harm reduction services in prisons and what prisoners can access. Even though the Bangkok rules, the Nelson Mandela rules indicate that people in prison should have the same access to services that people outside of prison have, we don't see this at all. And finally, one of the other areas we wanted to really look at was Indigenous people and harm reduction, because Indigenous people have truly been left out of the harm reduction response. And we wanted to be able to address that, because not only do they experience the effects of colonization so acutely, and on top of that, another layer of structural racism. And so I want to, you know, also say thanks, Sam, for being here. Sam actually opened up the first drug consumption room in the United States in that political environment. And it is an Indigenous person who did it. So, you know, if we actually listened to our Indigenous people, particularly those of us who come from countries where Indigenous people were basically taken over or wiped out or the numbers reduced to such enormous extents, that a lot of the times they have become invisible. And we want to be able to celebrate the fact that that was a huge undertaking in a country like the United States in the current context. So this is one of the reasons we decided to add these three additional thematic chapters along with the one we normally do on viral hepatitis. And with the regional chapters, we also decided to look at what are the key issues in a region. Now, of course, in every region, it is extremely diverse, and we know that. We know that we clump all of Asia together, and we really shouldn't. However, our regions are based on where we have our networks and where we're able to actually validate data, because we look at what is happening in a country and what is happening regionally. And so we want to be able to work with all our partners around the world to be able to do that. And what we decided to do was look at just two issues in a region. So it could be the lack of drugs checking services. It could be the lack of harm reduction interventions for stimulants users. It could be dire funding crises. It could be that in, for example, the Middle East and North Africa, the lack of engagement of people who use drugs in program development, conceptualization, implementation, monitoring, and evaluation. So that those are some of the slight differences compared to the 2022 report. Let me go ahead and start sharing some of the data with you. So, as I mentioned, we have seen a slight increase in the availability of harm reduction services since the 2022 report. However, people who use drugs still lack harm reduction services. Just lack. There's a lack of access, there's a lack of services, and there's a lack of understanding of what services are needed. And we found, of course, substantial regional differences still exist and are not being addressed. And the fact that there's stigmatization and criminalization of people who use drugs continues to be one of the largest and most significant issues impeding access to existing harm reduction services. And the major gap globally, particularly in a region like Latin America and the Caribbean, is that there is a lack of diverse harm reduction services to match the diversity of drugs that people are using. So for example, in Latin America and the Caribbean, we see more stimulant drugs being used rather than opioids, but we're not seeing equitable access to things like safer smoking kits. The methodology we use for this report is quite intensive. We have a global survey that goes out to hundreds of people around the world, and we provide it in Arabic, English, French, Spanish, and Russian. We have consultants in the nine regions, as well as our thematic chapters, who do a very complete literature review, and then we do a validation of the data we get at country level by our partners. And for the thematic chapters, we did additional surveys for each of the chapters, issue areas, as well as a literature review. And as I mentioned, we had contributions from around almost 300 people in 101 countries. And of course, there are limitations. We try to provide a global snapshot of harm reduction policies and programs, and it does not obviously comprehensively evaluate the quality of services in place, although we do try and highlight that as much as possible. Okay, so in terms of supportive references to harm reduction in national policy documents, we moved from 105 countries in 2022 to around 108 countries in 2024. And the most countries that we actually saw this movement and change and shift in was, of course, in Eastern and Southern Africa, where we saw countries like Ethiopia, Malawi, Mozambique, and Zimbabwe include harm reduction in their policies. We saw it in Latin America, in Brazil, Chile, and Costa Rica. And in West and Central Africa, in Cameroon, Sao Tome, and Principe, and Togo. And in Asia, we found it in Cambodia. Unfortunately, we could not confirm the continued inclusion of harm reduction in national policies in eight countries, which were actually on the list in 2022. And that includes the Dominican Republic, Ghana, Libya, Oman, the Philippines, Samoa, Syria, and Vanuatu. And of course, we mustn't forget that this, you know, inclusion and references to harm reduction in policies, in national policies, can actually mean very different things in very different places. So for example, in Ethiopia and Mozambique, only opioid agonist therapy is included. In Malawi, they have explicit references to harm reduction in several policies and including several of the health sector strategies. Brazil has supportive policies across the board. And so, you know, we're able to see some sort of differences and changes. However, we do see that, you know, Iran mentions harm reduction in one of their national documents. Unfortunately, they also still implement the death penalty for people who use drugs. And actually, more people were executed in 2023. The largest number were executed in 2023 since 2015. So quite concerning. We have a few more countries, six more countries that are actually providing opioid agonist therapy. 94 countries compared to 88 in 2022. But of course, coverage remains varied and limited. But new countries include Egypt, Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates, Peru, Benin, and Sierra Leone. And actually, in Sierra Leone, there's a small-scale opioid agonist therapy program, which is actually led by peer educators and run by a community group. Unfortunately, in West and Central Africa, we found that Nigeria ceased their opioid agonist therapy program. So you can see across the world where OAT is available in the community, that's the light blue color. Unfortunately, we see many more countries where it is not available. And yet, opioid agonist therapy is a very cost-effective intervention and should actually be provided in all countries. Similarly, with needle and syringe programs, we have an increase of one country. So this year, we found that Brazil, Bulgaria, and Ghana now have needle and syringe programs. Unfortunately, the Dominican Republic and Guinea do not. And the need for needle and syringe programs still far outstrips availability. And the latest review finds 190 countries and territories where injecting drug use has been documented, meaning that people who inject who inject drugs in 97 countries still do not have access. And here you can see on this map again, many of the same countries where you cannot find needle and syringe programs. Drug consumption rooms. This is the one where, we have two new countries, so Colombia and Sierra Leone. In Colombia, the first drug consumption room opened in 2023, and another one is expected to open this year. It is a community-based service for people who inject drugs with peers involved in the actual operation, as well as the development, implementation, and evaluation of the facility. In Sierra Leone, it's actually a drop-in center that has opened an informal drug consumption room. And we included it in the report because although local, with the caveat that local police and donors support the drop-in center, are aware of the drug consumption room's operation, it is not officially sanctioned or funded. But they're doing it anyway because they see a need. And I think that's what we also have to think about in the future is, do we have a need? Can we actually do this? And Sam will give us, can talk more about that later. Take-home naloxone is now available in 34 countries compared to 35 in 2022. And the two new countries are Colombia and Lebanon. And so in Colombia, we can see that change in government has allowed for a change in the policies and something more progressive when it comes to harm reduction and drug policy. Unfortunately, in South Africa, there are no community-based naloxone distribution programs. So it's still only available in medical settings, which is unfortunate because that's not necessarily where people who might be experiencing an overdose are going to be. Take-home naloxone in Colombia is now available after years of it being illegally provided by peers. But there's still, legal barriers that exist. So, for example, national guidelines require trained medical personnel to administer naloxone. And safer smoking equipment is distributed now in 25 countries. So we're seeing a few more, six more countries, South Africa, Bulgaria, Mexico, Puerto Rico, Greece, and Ireland. But this is where what we were talking about. This is a major gap. If we have entire regions that are shifting to different types of drugs and drug use, then we need to be able to be faster in our responses to those needs. When it comes to prisons, and this is why we had to talk about prisons in this report, because it is still extremely challenging to find harm reduction services in prisons. We found a needle and syringe program available in only 11 countries in 2024. And you can see the countries here. Most of them are actually in Eurasia and Western Europe. It is three more than in 2022. And Iran, North Macedonia, Ukraine now provide at least one NSP. But and so one of the things that we also found is that in Ukraine, which is in a challenging operating environment where they're at war, they opened the first prison NSP in Odessa prison in 2023 in collaboration with an NGO called Free Zone. And so they did a survey with prisoners and discovered that 50% of respondents had used drugs, 40% were interested in participating in the needle and syringe program. And so they developed a comprehensive service. So when we hear things like, oh, it's not possible in our context, well, let's remember Ukraine, who is currently at war and still able to do something like this. Opioid agonist therapy is available in at least one prison in 60 countries. Now compare that to 94 countries in the where you can find OAT in the community. And we found that it's now available in at least one prison in Algeria, Puerto Rico, and Turkey, but is no longer available in Bulgaria and Palestine. Take-home naloxone is available on release in at least one prison, also in only 11 countries, most of which are in Europe, North America, and there's one that we found in Australia in the Oceania region. But we would like to point out that Canada opened its first prison-based overdose prevention site, a drug consumption room, in 2019, and then they opened a further two in 2023 in Nova Scotia and in Ontario. And in federal prisons in Canada, 46 people died from suspected drug overdoses, and another 728 people non-fatally overdosed between 2011 to 2022. And to date, there have been no overdose deaths at any facility with an overdose prevention site since the service has been active. So we see the concrete evidence of how we can actually change lives.
That was Colleen Daniels, Acting Executive Director of Harm Reduction International, at a news conference October 29th announcing the release of HRI's new report, The Global State of Harm Reduction 2024. We'll hear more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Harm Reduction International's news conference featured speakers from around the world. Charity Monterang is Executive Director of Students for Sensible Drug Policy International.
As you mentioned, we know young people are using drugs. They are the most impacted by drug use. And yet, despite the growing recognition of young people's unique needs, they remain largely neglected in programming. Harm reduction services are designed for adult users. And so they're really not, they're not accessible. They don't meet the needs of young people and adolescents. And I think this is one thing that really stood out for us, even when trying to find information. So when we did the chapter, we started out with a survey. In the chapter, you'll realize that there are some regions that we're not able to get information from. However, we did manage to get some literature review information, which is still quite limited. There isn't enough research on young people accessing harm reduction services at all, more recently rather. And so young people experience different challenges. There aren't any youth-centric or youth-focused programs within our different regions. In Africa, for example, where you generally don't have adequate harm reduction services, services for young people are just like an afterthought. And so we need to really take into consideration the regional and cultural aspects. And I'm so glad we had Indigenous populations here, Sam and Tracy, speaking on the need to really localize harm reduction services. And when you think about young people, they experience double stigma. The fact that they're young and the fact that they are using drugs, very similar to women as well. Women are seen, who use drugs are seen as anomalies, and young women as well. And so in the chapter, we also try to look at the intersecting identities of young people. So young people who use drugs and are sex workers, young people who are neurodivergent and so forth. So we really try to encapsulate all of these intersecting identities of young people. And so what a key or what an ideal harm reduction service would look like, or youth-friendly harm reduction services would look like, is to really ensure that harm reduction services are rooted in accessibility. confidentiality and youth leadership. A lot of harm reduction services do not have young people that work within their programs, and so they will not appeal to young people. The legal barriers that young people experience, where you need to have permission from a parent, or you need to have a parent like escorting you to access services, prevents young people from accessing services. Age restrictions as well. We are aware that young people under 18 are using drugs. However, services are not catered or tailored for adolescents. There's this denialism or reluctance to acknowledge adolescent drug use, and so services will not necessarily cater to them. And so going back now to ensuring that we are having youth-friendly services is making them accessible through either schools, online platforms, community spaces that are familiar to young people. And I'll speak again, emphasizing the importance of youth leadership in services and ensuring that young people are included in programming, implementation, and policy and general policy discussions. So while we in the need to also train and empower young people who use drugs is also important, ensuring that they are not just included but prioritized as well. And so regionally as well, when you look at Africa, for example, as I mentioned, the reluctance to acknowledge adolescent drug use. Policies do not cater for them, which means they're not able to access them. Rural communities, young people in rural areas are not accessing services. This is obviously because of accessibility. So really ensuring that our services not only cater for urban populations or urban young people, but also catering for young people in rural communities.
That was Charity Monterang, Executive Director of Students for Sensible Drug Policy International, speaking at a news conference on the release of Harm Reduction International's new report entitled The Global State of Harm Reduction 2024. Let's hear from one of the other speakers. Sam Rivera is Executive Director of OnPoint in New York.
We provide an array of services. So someone will come into our overdose prevention center and use it, and then eventually start saying, maybe I want to go to the low threshold medical center. Maybe I want to go upstairs and receive some of the holistic services, acupuncture, acupressure, some good natural medicine, again, in indigenous ways, participating and have an opportunity to shower and rewash your clothes and receive mental health services. I mean, when we talked about opening mental health services in our OPCs and literally offering them within the OPC, literally inside the room itself, people questioned it. And what we realized is that once again, as indigenous people, we move in a way where we give you medicine wherever we can give it to you. And so looking at that for us was a natural response. And so of course people question that because we're used to it. So we accepted their questions and continued to move on. So people enter and enter our ways and enter our space in that energy, realizing that all of these services are accessible. And what we know is since we've been open almost 3 years now, we have over 80% of our participants who are using the OPC are utilizing other services. And that speaks to that opportunity and making it available for our people. At our point, we say we are the medicine. It's a big deal, to use that term. We, the human being, is the medicine. Even when you respond to an overdose, even when you administer some medication, it takes the human to administer that. That makes you a medicine person, right? I don't want you to take over the rule or the right of medicine women. They own that, but we will give you some kudos and some credit for being a medicine person in that way. The holistic approach is everything, literally looking at a person's full potential. We are honored, and we honor the people who come in to see us. I ask people that if you do this work and people show up to your space, see that as an honor, see that as a responsibility to respond to what they're showing, to respond to the needs they have. It is our responsibility. It's not, I wouldn't look at it as a job. You've been blessed and asked to participate in this. And so that's really the approach we want to see every time someone has the courage to walk in, right? Someone has the energy and time to show up to your door. Honoring them as much as possible, honoring the community, even when the community doesn't agree with what you're doing. So as an example, when we first opened, we started reaching these milestones, right, where we did our first 100 overdose interventions, then 200. We were thanking and acknowledging people in the community who didn't agree with what we were doing. And that's also a very holistic and indigenous way to pull people in, because then they look at it from a different way, right? We don't push our enemies away. We keep them close, and we work with them in a very healthy way. The other thing is we're in America. We're in America, in a place that's very patriarchal, right? Moves in this energy where they don't want to see matriarchs, right? They don't want to bless that. And as indigenous person, people is very different. Women lead. You know, I come from a nation of Taínos where the Spaniards were upset to learn that we had women as chiefs. They thought it was weak for us to have women as chiefs. Well, just look at this panel. You better wake up, right? And look at the work across, look at this, the women across our work, right? And so I and my mom, who if it wasn't for my mom, I wouldn't have any of the good I have. Any good I have is because of mom. A true warrior who was a nurse for 42 years in New York City and took care of people in the most amazing and loving way. And so being able to move in that energy from my beautiful indigenous mom is really a blessing. You know, you mentioned the Dominican Republic not having an SSP or having certain exchanges. These are Taíno people. And it hurts me, and it hurts my soul that, and I mentioned this a few times, and I'm glad it's coming up for me again, where if my people, who are Taínos, we're talking South Haiti, Dominican Republic, all down the Caribbean, right? Jamaica, Puerto Rico, all these other terms, names they use, all the way down to Cuba and even South Florida. If all of our people who are in those, who lived and their people, the ancestors are from those areas, and realize that we're not Latino, we're not American, we are Taíno people. We are Taíno people, the first people who Columbus met, and why he thought he was in India seeing our brownness. Can you imagine the impact that would have on our senses? In the United States, the impact it would have on realizing the success of indigenous people in this country. So I ask my people who are from these lands to identify with who you are, with your ancestors and your ancestry. With 2 minutes ago, I want to make sure that there's also another issue going on in this country where we're watching the United States celebrate a 10% decrease in overdose deaths. And that's shameful, because one thing is we're watching overdose deaths decrease in a population that doesn't look like us, right? And that is celebrated. How do you celebrate that? It speaks to, again, the oppression that our people have to experience in this work, where people now want to shift the conversation from 110,000 overdose deaths in this country to this celebration of 10%. And meanwhile, Black and brown communities continue to go up.
That was Sam Rivera, executive director of On Point in New York, speaking at a news conference on the release of Harm Reduction International's new report entitled The Global State of Harm Reduction 2024. For now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Find this edition of Century, along with an archive of past shows, at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.